Do you remember this dramatic Sydney news from September 2009?
Police are following a number of leads in their investigation into the murder of a man in Sydney's north last night. Michael McGuirk was shot in the driveway of his Cremorne home in what police say was a targeted killing. The 45-year-old businessman was on assault and arson charges until 2 weeks ago and was due to face court over a property dispute today.
Well, there's the news read by our Helen Zaremas back in 2009. Michael McGuirk, shonky businessman and crook, shot dead in the driveway of his Sydney home, horrifyingly, in front of his 9-year-old son. Less than 2 weeks before, he'd telephoned the Herald's investigative reporter, Kate McClymont, predicting just such an event and identifying the man who'd taken out the contract on his life. Well, Kate has told the gripping, colourful, horrific, sometimes blackly funny story of McGuirk, his enemy, Ron Medich, and a colourful cast of bit players suited to a story by Damon Runyon. And she's here in the studio. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Richard.
This is such an amazing story. Let's talk about McGuirk first, the man who died in his Cremorne driveway. You call him the sociopath next door.
Yes, well, for quite a long time while there's been court cases on, Michael McGuirk has just been the victim. And there has never been much about him. There was, you know, when he was first murdered, because police were really worried because there were so many people who wanted him dead at the time. So, you know, just as business techniques, there was sort of firebombing, assaults, you know, providing people with prostitutes, then blackmailing them. He was really a very unpleasant piece of work.
Well, here's one emblematic story from your book, which I'd never read. There's a lot of stuff in the book you've never read before. For instance, this, he's got the older son, I think, going to Riverview, and so he meets quite well-heeled parents at Riverview, and he manages to convince two of the fathers to give him some money for a business deal, and then when no profits are returned, the men eventually say, well, you know, could we see the money back and maybe we could have a meeting. He turns up to the meeting with these two fellow parents, and he has two sheets of paper in his hand, and he gives one sheet of paper to one father and the other sheet of paper to the other father. And listed on those sheets of paper is each man's wife and children, and
where they'd been,
all their activities for the previous week, down to the times and places where they'd been. After which he says, "Are you sure you want to pursue this?"
I know. It's, you know, and I think that we don't understand that, you know, Sydney, you know, it's this beautiful glittering harbour, but underneath the veneer of civility, there is like an undercurrent of extraordinarily corrupt dealings, bad behaviour. And these are not your garden variety criminals. These are exceptionally well-paid, well-to-do people who are at their heart as sociopaths, really. It's extraordinary.
In his case, living in a harbourside mansion.
Yes. Yeah. But, I mean, there was another case where he, you know, he threatens somebody who takes out an AVO. So they come out of court. This is in Waverley Court. And the man's thinking, you know, I've got an AVO. He can't approach me. And he's having a quiet ciggy outside the court. And McGuirk comes up and says to him, "You really think that is going to stop me?" So he'd breached the AVO within 5 minutes of
getting being issued.
It.
Yeah. Yes. He starts out in this line of work really early. He grows up in Glasgow in very straitened circumstances, a very poor family. Very quickly, though, he finds himself in Kaiserslautern. The Americans call it K-Town because it's where one of the big American bases was in Germany. He's selling Mercedes-Benz.
Yes, so he's selling Mercedes-Benz, and this was something that he was to do for the rest of his life. He would be, you know, he was a fabulous salesman, if only he'd put his mind to telling the truth. So he said to an American serviceman, "I can get you this fantastic deal on a Merc. It'll be half price if you come in cash." So the guy comes in cash, you know, before he can get a car. McGurk's at the local airport, has fled Germany and gone to, I think, gone to Spain with his brother.
with the 20,000 or whatever it is.
And he did the same. The first job he had in Australia was in a Jaguar dealership up on the in the northern suburbs. And he was, you know, promising people, look, I will throw in for, you know, no extra, to seal the deal, I'll throw in, you know, free sunroof,
air conditioning.
And of course, none of it would ever materialise. But it never stopped him. And the fascinating thing about him was that every person who ever helped him, his friends, his colleagues, he dudded them all. And not only did he dud them, he would sue them. And I think that's, you know, the use of the court system. For instance, you know, one of his more harebrained schemes was trying to sell a miniature Koran that was actually dated to have been written at the time Queen Elizabeth I was on the throne. So it's 400 years old. It's the size of a matchbox. It's jeweled. He gets it from a KGB operative in Moscow and then tries to flog it to the Sultan of Brunei. And when the Sultan doesn't buy it for $8 million, he starts a lawsuit in the New South Wales Supreme Court against the Sultan of Brunei, you know, one of the richest men.
Well, I think at the time, the richest man.
Yes, exactly.
So, the use of the court system, the use of violence, the use of this sort of sequence of things he's doing, that he's the victim. On the other side of this compelling book is, well, I won't call him the perpetrator because he doesn't actually shoot the gun, but he's the guy who the court system has found organised at all. His name is Ron Medich. He was the guy who, along with his brother, set up, for instance, quite well known in inner west of Sydney, the Norton Street
shopping centre
with Coles and all that sort of stuff. They developed that. This is a person who has traded influence all their lives with politicians and so forth.
I know, but I think the interesting thing with Ron Medich was that he was an enormous success when he was doing business with his younger brother, Roy. They're only 18 months or a year apart. And I think Roy had the business brains, Ron not so much. In fact, his nickname was Cotties, owing to him being thick and rich, like the ice cream topping. So,
well, there's even a moment you quote in court where his barrister, Winston Tarancini, is sort of goading Lucky Gattaleri on the stand, and he basically says, well, let's face it, you know the truth. Your boss, Tarancini's boss, too, he's not very bright.
I know, and then Lucky shoots back, you know, he can't be paying you too much, can he? But another part of the book, too, is the price of justice, the fact that Ron Medich, with all his wealth, was able to stay out of jail until last year. That's 9 years after the murder. Whereas Lucky Gattaleri had nothing. And so when he was first arrested, he turned to Ron Medich, got a message to him saying, Ron, I'll need $1 million to defend this and for my bail money. And Ron gets a message back saying, Ron gets a message back to Lucky saying, sorry, pal, you're on your own. And so that's what turned Lucky Gattaleri. You know, he had committed a murder for this man. And yet when
he'd be the prime organiser.
Well, yes. And, you know, even the hitman that they had were so hopeless. Like most of the people in this book are just, you know, dullards. And you wonder, I think, you know, when you played that news bulletin then, I remember at the time it was sort of thought that this was a professional hit. And in fact, it was somebody who was a 45-year-old accounts manager accompanied by a 19-year-old kid. You know, they'd got to the murder scene. They were so nervous that the 19-year-old went down to the local Bottle-O to buy a bottle of bourbon, but they wouldn't serve him because he was too young and didn't have ID. So then the next guy, the 45-year-old, is also seen at the bottle shop on the night of the murder. They almost prang
the getaway car. Bottle shops famously have CCTV footage.
Exactly. And then they almost prang the getaway car at the first roundabout. They don't have an e-tag, so they're photographed going across the harbour bridge. And then when they get home, they burn their clothes because they've seen so many movies. But the 45-year-old Hassam Safetli forgets that he's got some of the murder money in his back pocket. So he's burning his fingers trying to get his clothes back. Like, you know, and I think as his own brother, you know, said to one of the organisers, and they think that this was a professional job.
Kate McClymont is here talking about her new book. It's called Dead Man Walking, The Murky World of Michael McGurk and Ron Medich. I mentioned at the beginning, one of the really freaky things about this is he rings you up 10 days before that scene where he's shot in on his driveway in Cremorne. He rings you up, doesn't he?
Yes, and he rang up to say, because we'd been writing stories about his firebombing, his assaults, and the fact that there was a lawsuit over a $17 million house in Wolseley Road in Point Piper. Wolseley Road, of course, being not only the most expensive strip of real estate in Australia, but the 10th most expensive, you know, strip of real estate in the entire world. And here's a firebombing. So when we wrote the story, he was very angry and said, look, you've got it all wrong. He said, you should be looking at Ron Medich. And when we didn't look at Ron Medich, he rang up and said, you know, Ron Medich has got a hit out on me. He's going to have me killed and Lucky Gattalari's going to do it. So 10 days later when it happened, I remember the call.
Did you believe him at the time?
No. You know, people say all kinds of things to get you to do their bidding. Like as a journalist, you know that people are trying to use you. You know that they can see an opportunity to use you to damage their, you know, their rival or their nemesis. And that's what I thought that he was doing. But the funny thing was for us, when the murder actually happened, he was killed, Michael McGurk was killed at 6:30 p.m. You know, this is in leafy North Shore, Cremorne. Within half an hour, I had received a call from our news desk to say Michael McGurk's just been murdered, and I felt physically ill, like just ill, you know, thinking, you know, should I have done something? But we couldn't say that Ron Medich was, you know, we could say that McGurk had tipped us off as to his likely assassin. But we couldn't mention his name in the paper because if Ron Medich sued, we would have to prove that he was the murderer. So for a long time, you know, we would say, we are not suggesting that Ron Medich is involved when in fact we were suggesting.
Well, McGurk had had previous meetings with you, hadn't he? There's a description in the book of you and Vanda going to this restaurant and him talking about the tape. Tell us about the tape.
Yes, so what he had done was in the months before his death, you know, he had all these ploys to try to make Ron Medich pay him money. That the two of them were locked into, you know, a whole pile of lawsuits about property deals. You know, basically,
having been sort of associates before.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. So they'd fallen out, and in fact, when McGurk was charged with the firebombing in January of 2009, it was Medich that put up the $100,000 bail money and then later, you know, withdrew it. No one could understand why at the time. So when these two are fighting each other in the court, it was just, you know, a bizarre thing that we couldn't quite work out, you know, why they were doing this. So for him to ring up and say, you know, you've got to be looking at Ron Medich because I've got a tape recording. And this was not the first time we'd heard it. It was a very ill-kept secret throughout the eastern suburbs. And of course, when there's a secret, when there's a rumour, it expands to be, you know, oh, it's the, you know, it's the premier, mm-hmm. it's the planning minister.
But the idea was that he had this tape where Medich listed all the politicians and senior officials who he had managed to successfully corrupt.
And in fact, he did have a tape. And in the days after the murder, those who had a copy of the tape were absolutely petrified that they were going to be killed as well. I think there was about four copies of the tape. And in actual fact, on the tape was Ron Medich saying things like, you know, who he'd paid and the fact that they needed to push their developments through because the Labor government wasn't going to be in for all that much longer. But funnily enough, the independent commission against corruption took Ron's word that he was just big noting. I just think at the time they just didn't think this kind of corruption existed mm-hmm. in Sydney, which so, was so more
even,
for
even though
them.
Even though people have heard the tape, the names have never come out publicly?
Look, they have come out publicly, but Ron Medich said, I was just big noting, of course, I didn't pay that. And that's not to say that there is proof that he did. And it's quite clear that none of those people ever had corruption findings or anything like that made against them. But the fact that he was somebody who had committed a murder and was now before ICAC, you know, just saying, oh, no, I was only pretending. But once Lucky Gattulari was arrested, Ron was found corrupt in two other corruption inquiries. So I think that they got wind that Ron perhaps wasn't as clean as he had appeared initially.
The tape at one point is listened to by Graham Richardson, of all people. Medich gets him to listen to it as his kind of agent, as his ears, and he says, look, actually, it's very hard to hear. I wouldn't worry about it. That scene reminds me, in a way, of how many people are in this book. You get a sense that, I'm not saying Richardson's in the demimonde at all, but if you just concentrate on the demimonde of Sydney, of people like Roger Rogerson, the corrupt cop, you know, various ministers whose names we know about, they all seem to know each other, deal with each other, have lunch together, often at the same restaurant. It's the connections are so interesting.
Oh, look, I find that fascinating. You know, how these people find each other. The fact that Graham Richardson was on the Medich's payroll, he was getting $5,000 a month for, you know, some time before, and this was trying to get through. The Medich's had bought land at Badgerys Creek in the hope that an airport would finally be developed. And funnily enough, all these years later, they sold it, I think 2 years ago, for a rumoured $500 million to a Chinese property developer.
Okay, this is land that they bought from the CSIRO in a process that had no tender.
That's right. And I think at the time the chairman of the CSIRO was Neville Rann, and it turned out that both Ron Medich and Michael McGuirk were later in a pizza business with Neville Rann. I mean, you can't make this up.
That's where it starts to read like Damon Runyon or something like that. You know, everyone knows each other. They're all behaving together. One of the saddest things, as you say, is these sort of bit players in it, the absolute Damon Runyon sort of characters like Lucky Gattulari. He serves a lot of time in prison for what he's done. He observes to you right towards the end, because he's thinking of the good times he had when the money was rolling everywhere. They would sit at the Tuscany restaurant, order the most expensive wine. They had the various corrupt officials at their beck and call. Life was pretty good. They'd go to the, I mean, not this is a my definition of a good life, but these two would go to the same brothel virtually every afternoon.
Yes,
you know, marvelous.
Babylon down at Chinatown.
Marvellous. We had such a great life, he told you, of his time with Medich. We really did. It was such a great life. Why did we ruin it? Why didn't Ron just leave it? He means, you know, forget about McGuirk. Why did I do it for him? Then the prison guards come and take him away. It's one of the last things in the book. It's a pretty good question, though, isn't it? Why did Medich risk so much to knock off a minor business rival who was annoying him?
I think, you know, what he kept saying to Lucky Gattulari was that he's making me the laughing stock of the eastern suburbs. Well, I mean, I don't know whether that was true, but he was also affecting his marriage to his wife, Odetta. So McGuirk was, you know, showing him up to be a fool and, you know, had sold him, you know, for, you know, some mad reason. Ron Medich had gone on holidays to Hawaii and had given McGuirk his power of attorney. So in the week he was away, he bought not one but two properties, and then he doubled the cost to Ron. So he was pocketing millions along the way. And I think Ron just could not bear the shame of being shown up as an idiot. But Lucky also had the motivation that you know, despite his very poor business record, he'd been a bankrupt. Every crazy deal, you know, Aboriginal funeral funds, all these, you know, crackpot ideas had all come to naught. Ron Medich had invested almost $16 million into Lucky's failed electrical companies. So, you know, Lucky, I think, had his own motive to keep on Ron's good side. But, you know, why wouldn't you just say, oh, Ron, forget it. Move on. It's
and
it's
the crime
ridiculous.
And the crime having been committed, why wouldn't Medich then do everything he could to shower Lucky Gattalari with enough money to try to keep him from turning witness?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's one of the you know, the points of it all is that with all this money, why wouldn't you have flung a little bit more Lucky's way in the vague hope that it might not come home to you?
Mm. We'd be such good criminals, Kate. The society is so lucky that we've decided to walk
to turn our talents to good.
To turn our talents to good, as you have done spectacularly with this book. It is so gripping. Some of it is blackly funny. Lots of it is horrific. And, yeah, you get a real sense of the town, not to suggest that everyone in Sydney is corrupt, but you've got a sense of this strata, who all seems to know each other. And who are not working for the benefit of the rest of us.
No.
Kate McClellan, thank you very
much. Thanks so much, Richard.
It is a very gripping read. It's one of those books which, once you start reading it, you will not be able to put down. Kate McClellan, Dead Man Walking, The Murky World of Michael McGurk and Ron Medich.